Brisbane Visa, which came out in the summer last year, and MasterCard and Merricks, which came out in December last year, as well as having a look at the future of competition and class action litigation in the UK. We're very fortunate to have with us today counsel who appeared in the Supreme Court in those two cases, Christopher Brown and Victoria Wakefield QC, along with one of the leading experts on class actions, among other matters, of course, Professor Rachel Mulheron. Professor Mulheron will be chairing this webinar, and we'll provide further details on our speaker's experience in a moment. Before she does so, I'd just like to extend thanks on behalf of the Competition Law Association, who are very grateful to all three of the panel for taking their time and to share their thoughts and experience with us today. Before handing over, I just have a few housekeeping matters to address. Firstly, to highlight another upcoming event for the Competition Law Association, there will be a talk on the 3rd of March, 12:30, lunchtime talk, with Robert Palmer QC and Deva Das of Freshfields, presenting on competition direct disqualification proceedings, latest case law and practical considerations, which promises to be very interesting. I hope you will join us for. Full details and registration are available on the new events section of CLA's website. Second point is you should have received an evaluation form and could ask everyone to complete and return the feedback form, which was circulated with the dial-in link. It's always very helpful to speakers to have that feedback. Thirdly and finally, I'd like to remind you all to use the Q&A function on Zoom if you want to ask any questions, which are very welcome. Participants, if you could type your question into the function and then we'll select questions to be answered after the speakers have delivered their presentations. So without further ado, I'll pass over to Professor Mulheron. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Nicholas, and a warm welcome to all audience members today for this fascinating seminar. We have two Supreme Court decisions at issue today, and without further ado, I'd like to introduce our two learned and knowledgeable speakers. Our first speaker is Christopher Brown, who is a barrister at Matrix Chambers. Christopher's practice focuses on competition law, and as well as acting for ASDA and others in the ongoing interchange fee litigation against MasterCard, which is the subject of today's discussion, Christopher is involved in a number of other private damages actions, including acting for Lloyds Banking Group in its defense of a US dollar LIBOR claim. In addition to his competition law work, Christopher's diverse practice also involves EU law, sports law, and public law. Away from his practice areas, Christopher is also visiting fellow at King's College London, where he teaches UK competition law on the LLM, and he also finds time to be a member of the advisory board of the Competition Law Journal. In his talk today, Christopher will be speaking about the decision of the Supreme Court delivered on the 17th of June last year, Sainsbury's Supermarkets and Visa Europe Services, in which he acted for the second respondent. Our second speaker today is Victoria Wakefield of Queen's Counsel, who is a barrister at Brick Court Chambers. Victoria will be speaking on the Supreme Court judgment of Merricks and MasterCard, which was delivered on the 11th of December last year, in which Victoria is instructed by Walter Merricks, the representative claimant in that action. Victoria is also involved in other notable collective proceedings involving the application of competition law, including her representation of Mr. Evans in his claim in relation to foreign exchange infringements before the CAT, and which litigation includes a carriage dispute between two competing proposed representative claimants. Outside the realm of competition law, Victoria is also instructed in the key and significant litigation which is being presently pursued under the representative action, namely Lloyd and Google, which concerns alleged data infringement issues. Victoria is instructed by Mr. Lloyd in that important litigation, and that case is due to be heard by the Supreme Court later in April. Hence, as you can see, each speaker brings to this seminar today a wealth of knowledge and expertise about the litigation which they are to discuss. Each speaker will speak for approximately 20 minutes, and there will be opportunity for questions from the audience toward the end of the seminar. So over to you, Christopher. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that introduction, Rachel, and thank you to the CLA for inviting me to speak today. It's a lunchtime seminar, so perhaps some allusion to lunch is appropriate. If you think of my talk as the hors d'oeuvre before the plat principal to be delivered by Victoria, I suspect that hers may be of wider interest given the nascent nature of the collective actions regime. But in over the course of the next 15 to 20 minutes, I will, as Rachel outlined, be trying to provide an overview of the key points to emerge from the first Supreme Court judgment, that of Sainsbury's and MasterCard, or Sainsbury's and Visa. I wasn't acting for Sainsbury's, I was acting for the AAM claimants, as to Argos and Morrisons. The appeals were all heard together. So essentially, I'll be talking to you about the retailer interchange litigation, whereas Victoria will be talking about the Merricks case. So I'll be summarising the key points from the retailer judgment, but then I'll also say something, hopefully, if time permits, about subsequent developments in the litigation, so developments since judgment was handed down by the Supreme Court in June 2020. And I wish to give you this apology in advance, which is that some of what I'll say is going to be rather anodyne, for the simple reason that, of course, the litigation that I am instructed in is still ongoing, so there's a limit to what I can say today. Perhaps on a future occasion I can be a little more liberal in what I say, in the scope of my remarks. Suzanne, if we can just go to the first main slide, just one further on, please. Thank you. I won't dwell on this slide, but simply to remind you, if you need reminding, what an interchange fee is. You may, if you've looked in any detail at any of the judgment, various interchange fee judgments, you'll have seen a diagram similar to this one. Essentially, the interchange fee is a fee paid by the merchant's bank, the acquirer or acquiring bank, to a cardholder's bank, the issuing bank, each time that a credit card or debit card is used to effect payment. According to the scheme rules of the two four-party schemes, Visa and MasterCard, issuers and acquirers may agree bilaterally on the question of an interchange fee and what that level should be. But in default of any such bilateral agreements, the so-called multilateral interchange fee set by the scheme applies. And in practice, bilateral agreements are unheard of, or virtually unheard of, and that is perhaps no surprise, because it wouldn't be in the interests of an acquiring bank to pay more than the default fee, and likewise it's not in the interests of issuing banks to accept any less. And you may recall from the Competition Appeal Tribunal's judgment in the Sainsbury's and MasterCard case that this question of whether bilateral agreements would be struck in the absence of the MIF was raised, and ultimately the Court of Appeal found that the tribunal's bilateral's counterfactual was flawed for this basic reason. If we can just go to the next slide, please. So on this slide, and apologies for the amount of text, which goes right down to the bottom, I've simply sought to summarise what has happened, the ins and outs of the lead retailer litigation. So there have been three trials thus far in the retailer litigation. The first in time to be tried was that was the claim brought by Sainsbury's against MasterCard. That was heard in early 2016 with judgment later that year. Shortly after judgment came out, the AAM trial against MasterCard took place, with judgment given in January 2017, which was slap bang in the middle of the third trial, which was a joint Sainsbury's and AAM trial against Visa, albeit that the AAM proceedings were compromised very shortly before the end of that trial. And that resulted in two judgments of Mr. Justice Phillips in November 2017 and February 2018. On Article 101 and 101.1 and 101.3, respectively. It's fair to say that the three judgments came to very different conclusions and based on very different reasoning. The tribunal's judgment in Sainsbury's MasterCard was the only one to find an infringement of Article 101, but based on a counterfactual, which, as I have already mentioned, was ultimately found to be flawed. The two High Court judgments came to the same ultimate conclusion that there was no infringement of Article 101.1, but for very different reasons. Mr. Justice Popplewell in the AAM case based his conclusion on the question of objective necessity, saying that in the counterfactual, it should be assumed that Visa would continue to set its MIFs and that therefore there would be substantial issuer and cardholder migration to Visa if there were no MasterCard MIFs, basically leading to the system, the MasterCard system, drying up and dying. Whereas Mr. Justice Phillips in the High Court case found that the MIF simply was not restrictive of competition, and I'll come on to elaborate on that in a short while. The cases all went on appeal to the Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal essentially upheld the retailers' appeals, and indeed Visa's appeal on the 101.3 issue in the second judgment of Mr. Justice Phillips, and the Court of Appeal remitted the cases to the CAT. But that wasn't the end of the matter. We then went to the Supreme Court and had a four-day hearing, a very long hearing in the Supreme Court, culminating in the judgment we're talking about today. Perhaps we can go to the next slide. So there were three main issues. Perhaps the next one, please, Suzanne. There were three main issues before the Supreme Court in the retailer litigation. There was the question of restriction of competition. There was a question, two questions related to exemption, and then the question of pass-on. And there was also a cross-appeal by the AAM parties, which I'll touch on in due course. Just dealing briefly with the restriction of competition issue, this was a case, an effects case rather than an object case. And obviously for an effects case, there needs to be a counterfactual against which to assess the measures in question. And whilst initially in the litigation, or at least in our litigation, there was a dispute as to the correct counterfactual, certainly by the time we got to the Court of Appeal, the counterfactual was common ground, which is default settlement of par. That is to say, in the absence of bilateral agreements, there would be no the issuing bank and the acquiring bank would simply settle at the face value of the transaction. Now, the scheme's central argument was that in a world in which there was a default settlement of par rule, that world was no more competitive than a world with multilateral interchange fees. Either way, there was a collective agreement, and either way, acquirers only competed over the so-called acquirer margin, that is to say, the bit of the merchant service charge, which reflected acquirers' own costs and profit margin. And the schemes also argued that the EU proceedings in the MasterCard EEA MIF case did not mandate a different result. The schemes argued that the Commission's decision in the MasterCard case turned on a finding that there would be greater uncertainty in the counterfactual, in the settlement at par or prohibition on ex post pricing counterfactual. And according to the schemes, that finding was upheld. It was that finding that was upheld on appeal to the EU courts. The Court of Appeal rejected those arguments and held that it was bound to find in the circumstances on the facts that there was a restriction of competition, that the factual matrix was in all relevant respects the same in the domestic litigation and the EU proceedings. And so as a matter of EU law, it was bound. And so that was the question for the Supreme Court, really. And if you go to the next slide, this is where I set this out. Suzanne, if you could just go to the next slide, please. So the question really, the narrow legal issue on restriction of competition was whether the court was bound by the judgment of the Court of Justice in the MasterCard case. and the Supreme Court held yes, it was, precisely because the factual findings in both cases were the same. The non-negotiable MIF was determined by a collective decision between undertakings rather than by competition. It had the effect of setting a minimum price floor for the merchant service charge. In the counterfactual, there would be no bilaterally agreed interchange fees, but the whole of the MIF would be determined by competition and the merchant service charge would be lower. So the whole of the MSC would be open to competitive bargaining on the part of merchants, rather than most of the MSC being immunised against competitive bargaining by virtue of the MIF agreement. And so the Supreme Court said that the facts are essentially the same and it is a question of EU law. And the court said the this is not a Crean type case where the national court should be free to come to different factual findings, even in respect of the same market, and even where the Commission has already made factual findings in respect of the same market. Here, there wasn't any difference in the factual findings. It was a question of how you applied the law to those findings. Can you just go to the next slide, please, Suzanne? Just very briefly, I won't dwell on this, but the Supreme Court didn't rest its analysis there. It went on to ask itself, well, even if we're not strictly speaking bound, should the court in any event follow the Court of Justice's judgment? And the short answer was yes. Now, it seems to me that ultimately the restriction of competition issue is not of huge legal interest. It's obviously of great legal interest to those involved in the interchange fee cases, but perhaps of less interest more widely. The general principle confirmed by the Court of Justice is that where the Court of Justice has said that Article 101 applies or catches a certain set of facts, then it would be contrary to EU law for a domestic court to say, in respect of the same fact pattern, that Article 101 is not engaged. So perhaps that's of not of particularly great interest more widely, but I think the exemption issue, which I now turn to, Suzanne, if you could go to the next slide, is of greater interest. I've just set out on this slide what I think are the seven principles that the Court of Appeal identified in relation to Article 101.3, at least insofar as these cases were concerned. And I've highlighted two in red because these two were the two principles which were taken on appeal by the schemes. Perhaps I should deal with them in reverse order. The first is the nature or quality of the evidence which parties wishing to rely on Article 101.3 need to adduce in order to make out its conditions, satisfy the conditions, whether cogent factual and empirical evidence is needed. Court of Appeal said it was, and that was a question of EU law. And then the second point concerned the fair share condition of Article 101.3, which is where you've got a two-sided market, whether it's sufficient to say that consumers on both sides of the market can be, or benefits to them and their position overall is sufficient to satisfy the fair share condition, or whether you have to show that the adversely affected consumer group here, the merchants, must be left no worse off as a result of the restriction. So those are the two points on appeal. And if we can just go to the next slide, please. As on the first of those, on the quality of evidence point, the schemes argued that the Court of Appeal had gone too far, had erected an overly onerous evidential hurdle in requiring them to adduce cogent empirical evidence to satisfy Article 101.3. Essentially, their argument was that any evidence should, in principle, suffice, even if it's restricted to economic theory. And the Court of the Supreme Court rejected that argument. First of all, they said that the quality of evidence was a question of EU law and not just for domestic law. And then what they said was that when you are applying the first condition, of Article 1013, that necessarily calls for a balancing exercise, because you have to work out whether overall efficiencies or benefits will be created. And that does require balancing the disadvantages, the burdens brought about by the restrictive agreement against the benefits which are said to arise. And so necessarily there has to be empirical evidence to do that. Otherwise, the balancing exercise simply can't take place. And then on the fair share point, Supreme Court likewise agreed with the Court of Appeals interpretation, or rather, at least in terms of the result, the reasoning differed slightly. But essentially, the Supreme Court says, yes, it's not just a question of looking at whether overall, looking at all consumers on both sides of the market, they're left no worse off. If that were the test, then the second condition would be entirely redundant, because we've already worked that out at the first stage of the Article 1013 analysis. And the Supreme Court makes the perhaps rather obvious or trite point that the fair share condition adds an additional fairness requirement, and that's really what explains the difference between the two. And so, again, the scheme's argument was, or rather Visa's argument on that point, was rejected. Okay, I should move on to PASSON. I've only got a few minutes left, which is rather useful for me, because I don't want to say a great deal about it, as it's still very much live in the AAM litigation and indeed another interchange litigation. But the Court of Appeal made various findings about PASSON. Perhaps I should have highlighted in red the third bullet point there, the broad acts principle does not apply. This is the principle that unreasonable precision is not required of a claimant when seeking to prove its loss. It's a principle that goes back a very long time to the Watson-Laidlaw case in, if I remember rightly, in the 19th century. But the Court of Appeal said that while that applies to claimants seeking to prove their loss, it doesn't apply on the other side of the ledger when defendants are seeking to show that the claimant has mitigated its loss. And it was that which the Supreme Court took issue with. The Supreme Court said there's no reason in principle why the broad acts principle should not apply on both sides of the equation. If we can just go to the next slide, please. I think it is worth noting that the Supreme Court made a number of other comments about the PASSON issue. And I think the first is a trite one, but it's useful that we now have confirmation at the very highest level that PASSON is something that can be raised, although it's been assumed as much for quite a long time. Reference was made to it by the Court of Appeal in cases like Devonish Nutrition. It's now reached the Supreme Court, which has confirmed that trite point. But also, I think it's fair to say that there will need to be an intensive factual investigation in each case, at least each direct purchaser case, as to whether PASSON has taken place. And PASSON, there are two forms. It's not just passing on the overcharge in the form of increased retail prices. It may also take the form of negotiating cost reductions with suppliers. That is a point which the Supreme Court made, but it hadn't been made by the Court of Appeal. And it seems to me that direct purchaser disclosure will become one of the battlegrounds that will be keenly litigated in these sorts of cases, with defendants eager to invite the court or tribunal to draw adverse inferences where they consider disclosure to be lacking in any respect. And they'll draw sucker from the Supreme Court's observations about the evidential burden that some claimants to provide evidence as to how they've dealt with cost recovery in their business. That's about 20 minutes. My 20 minutes is pretty much up. If I can just go to the next slide, just extremely briefly. I mentioned that the AAM parties had cross-appealed the Court of Appeal's decision, and that was on the disposal of their own appeal. The Court of Appeal had remitted the AAM case to the CAT for further consideration of the exemption issues in that case. The Supreme Court agreed with the points that the AAM parties made, which was that actually the Court of Appeal had itself definitively rejected MasterCard's exemption arguments in its judgment, and so there was no scope for revisiting that. These that would offend against the principle of finality of litigation. So the AAM case now proceeds directly to quantum. There'll be no further consideration of exemption. And then the very final slide, perhaps I'll say something about it in Q&A if anyone's interested. But the lead cases all rumble on. They've all been set down for trial now, starting with Sainsbury's and MasterCard in October of this year and culminating, assuming no settlements, in the AAM quantum trial, which is listed for 8 weeks as of January 2023. So by my reckoning, I'll have been working on it for more than a decade if we get that far, which obviously is a source of great pleasure. I think probably that's enough from me now, and shall I just hand straight over to Victoria?
Thanks very much, Kit. So I'm going to start by giving a brief overview of the judgment of the Supreme Court in Merricks and MasterCard. I'll then consider in outline some possible consequences of the judgment on other collective proceedings. One point which I should make at the outset is that since I'm instructed by Walter Merricks and since our remitted application for a CPO is set down for a hearing next month, and similarly to the point made by Kit, I too am somewhat limited in what I can say in the talk today. I'll take an entirely adversarial approach, and there may, of course, be questions which sadly I can't answer, at least at present. So starting then with the outline of the judgment. As you'll all know, Merricks is also an interchange claim. It's a follow-on claim following the Commission's decision relating to the infringement between 1992 and 2007 or 8, that there's an issue in respect of the end date for the infringement. Of course, there followed the 7 years of litigation in Luxembourg, which came to a conclusion just shy of two years before we lodged our application for a CPO in September 2016, on the very cusp of limitation expiring. So of relevance to this talk are perhaps two aspects of the claim in particular. Firstly, the claim is brought on behalf of indirect purchasers. So we have the direct purchasers, the merchants, the retailers who paid the interchange fee, unlawfully elevated as it was. And we say that they passed on those fees to all their customers, the consumers, and that class constitutes everyone who shopped in a merchant which accepted MasterCards. Since that class is essentially everyone who bought things from shops, that means that the class is essentially the entire adult population. So a very big class. Secondly, the way the claim is brought depends entirely on the availability of aggregate damages. So aggregate damages are, of course, one of the great novelties of the CAT CPO regime. They were introduced by the primary legislation, and they're defined as an award of damages without undertaking an assessment of the amount of damages recoverable in respect of each represented person. And so in Walter's case, consistently with that statutory definition, we don't propose to calculate the damages suffered by each individual by reference to, for example, their spending pattern, which shops they went in, how much they spent in each year. Instead, we seek to calculate the damages suffered across the class as a whole. And that loss is calculated on a top-down basis. So what we do, very crudely, is to take the total volume of commerce, which is the total value of all transactions for which a MasterCard was used. The VOC is then multiplied by the difference between the unlawful interchange fee and the lawful counterfactual interchange fee, including one at zero. That gives us the total overcharge. We then work out how much of that overcharge was passed on to consumers by virtue of inflated retail prices across the economy. And the end result is an accurate assessment of damages suffered by the class as a whole, but calculated on that top-down basis. And critically, what we don't do, as I've said, is work out per person the loss that was suffered and then add them all together. That contrary approach has come to be referred to as the bottom-up approach to calculation. The claim as pleaded has a value of £14 billion. That's around £7 billion of damages and around £7 billion of interest. And as is widely known, the stage at which we currently are is still at the application for a collective proceedings order. So that first application for a CPO. And it would be well known by all of you attending the webinar today that a CPO has to be granted by the CAT in order for collective proceedings to go ahead. There are two basic statutory conditions which need to be fulfilled in order for a CPO to be granted. The first relates to the proposed class representative, and that's called the authorisation condition. And the second relates to the claims, which is proposed to combine in the collective proceedings. And that's referred to as the eligibility condition. So each of those two criteria, authorisation and eligibility, of course, is the subject of detailed unpacking, both in statute rules and guidance and increasingly in case law. In the CAT, we lost on two distinct but related grounds, both relating to the eligibility criterion. So the first was that the claims were not suitable for an aggregate award of damages, in particular, because in the eyes of the CAT at least, there were too many difficulties in reliably calculating pass-on from merchants to consumers. And the second reason given by the CAT was that Mr. Merrick's proposals for distribution of any aggregate award did not reflect compensatory principles. And the proposal was that, and is that, there should be per capita distribution on an annualised basis. So you'll be a member of the class for any given year, and the amount of loss suffered by the class as a whole for that given year will be divided up on a flat per capita basis without reference to the individual loss of each class member. And the CAT said that was insufficiently compensatory at the individualised level. Of course, we appealed, we went to the Court of Appeal, and we won. And that court held that the CAT had committed five errors of law. Firstly, it had wrongly held that merchant pass-on was not a common issue. Secondly, in its approach to pass-on, the CAT had set an illegitimately high merits threshold at the CPO stage. Thirdly, that the CAT had effectively conducted a mini trial. Fourthly, that the CAT had been wrong to conclude that aggregate damages awards had to be distributed on a basis which had a relationship to compensation. And fifthly, that it had been premature for the CAT to reach a final and adverse conclusion about the proposed method of distribution at the certification stage. Of course, MasterCard appealed, we went to the Supreme Court and we won. So there are two judgments given by the Supreme Court. The majority judgment is given by Lord Briggs, with whom Lord Thomas agreed. And as is well known, Lord Kerr, who presided at the hearing, had also agreed that the appeal should be dismissed for the reasons set out in Lord Briggs's judgment. The draft judgment had already been circulated to the parties when Lord Kerr very sadly died. And of course, that gave rise to some limited delay and the reconstitution of the court as a court of four, but with it being agreed by Lord Sales and Lord Leggett that theirs would remain the minority view and that the appeal would be dismissed. So I'm going to address only the majority judgment of Lord Briggs. He starts with a substantive analytical section. So of course, there's all the recounting of the proceedings thus far and the statute and so on, but we get to his analytical section and he canvasses various principles, which I'll seek to summarize. So first of all, he says that a claimant who passes the strikeout or summary judgment test has an entitlement to a trial. Secondly, a court must strive to do the best it can to calculate damages with the evidence available, and the court must not simply throw up its hands. Thirdly, he says that there is nothing in the statutory scheme to suggest that this principle of justice, this is his words, the claimants who have suffered more than nominal loss by reason of the defendant's breach should have their damages quantified by the court doing the best it can on the available evidence, that principle of justice should be in any way watered down in collective proceedings. In fact, It's the converse. The evident purpose of the statutory scheme was to facilitate rather than to impede the vindication of those rights. Fourthly, he says that the word suitable, which appears in both suitable to be brought in collective proceedings, the eligibility condition, and also one of the factors that goes into it, suitable for an aggregate award of damages, has a relative meaning. So one compares collective proceedings with a claim brought individually, a single claim. It's a relative rather than an absolute assessment. Fifthly, he says that the compensatory principle has been radically modified by the statutory introduction of aggregate damages. Sixthly, he says that the certification process is not about and does not involve a merits test. And seventhly and finally, he distinguishes in the statutory regime between those criteria which form hard hurdles and those which are factors to be taken into account by the judge as part of his or her multifactorial assessment of whether the collective proceedings should go ahead. So having set out those various principles, Lord Briggs then turns to the grounds of appeal. And those, the conclusions which he reaches on the grounds of appeal are very much driven by the principles which he has already developed. Of particular interest here, I think, are three of his conclusions. So firstly, that relative suitability means that if the difficulties in the way of the resolution of the merchant pass-on issue would have been insufficient to deny a trial to an individual claimant, then they should not in principle lead to a denial of certification. Secondly, in respect of the right approach to the availability of evidence, he held that in respect of this issue, the CAT committed the most serious of its errors of law. And he says that even if data is incomplete and difficult to interpret, that's no reason to stop the trial going ahead. If those same difficulties would apply on an individual basis and would not give rise to strikeout or summary judgment. And thirdly, as to distribution, he says that it was a clear error of law for the CAT to seek to reintroduce individual compensation at the distribution stage when it had been removed by statute in the context of that aggregate award of damages. He also, on the other outstanding issues, held that pass-on is a common issue in our claim, but he did say that the Court of Appeal had gone wrong on two issues. One, whether there had been a mini trial, and the other, whether it would always be premature to consider distribution at the CPO stage. So that's where we are in the Supreme Court judgment. And of course, it's now been remitted and we're due to be back on in the tribunal at the end of March. Turning to the consequences of the Supreme Court judgment in other claims, I'd like to make seven observations. So I'll start with a pretty obvious one. There'll be more applications for summary judgment or strikeout. So that's obvious, of course, because the surmounting of those thresholds forms a core part of Lord Briggs's reasoning. When he talks about a claimant's entitlement to a trial, it's on the basis that the claimant has an arguable claim. Also, Lord Briggs, in his judgment, expressly refers to the availability of strikeout and summary judgment when he says this is not a merits assessment. He says, but of course it is, if there is a strikeout application or a summary judgment application that has been brought. And he also notes that those applications can be heard at the same time as the CPO hearing. So clearly, stating the obvious, it's to be expected that in future cases, an application for strikeout or summary judgment in respect of the whole of or part of an application for collective proceedings will be brought on. My second observation is that there may well be more emphasis on revisiting certification. So the primary legislation provides that the tribunal may vary or revoke a collective proceedings order at any time. And although that power does not occupy a central role in Lord Briggs's reasoning, he does refer to it. And going back to the Court of Appeal, they did place weight on that power. And indeed, Lord Sales and Lord Leggett criticised them for doing so. So my view is that it's to be expected that there will be a form of rolling vigilance on the part of respondents. And in particular, as any set of proceedings progresses, it's to be anticipated that the continued fulfilment of the requirements for certification will be kept under scrutiny. And by the same token, it's to be expected that there may well be applications to vary or revoke the CPO. The third point I've called back to basics. So Lord Briggs, of course, construes the regime against the background of the common law and general civil procedure. In particular, he looks at the principles which should apply to a court when considering a claim for damages brought individually. And that assessment is the point of departure for his relative suitability assessment. In Merricks, of course, the relevant common law and procedural authorities relate to assessment of damages where there are evidential difficulties. But it is to be anticipated, I would think, that this same approach, namely going back to basic principles of the common law and of civil procedure as they would apply in an individual claim, will obviously be picked up in other cases going forward, since that is the springboard for the relative assessment. And of course, that opens the door for some really interesting legal argument. The fourth observation, Canadian jurisprudence. As well as looking to English common law and civil procedure, Lord Briggs confirms that the Canadian jurisprudence is persuasive in our regime. And of course, it featured heavily in the judgment of the Court of Appeal and also in the tribunal. This will doubtless be picked up on by both sides to the argument, claimant and respondent. And I think it's entirely to be expected now that people do look to Canada when one's looking for a source of inspiration for a novel point. And this is a regime at present which is bristling with novel points. The fifth point, what about evidence for the CPO application and at the CPO hearing? So of course, the focus of Merricks was on the availability of data in respect of pass on to consumers. And I can't address that now given the live nature of the dispute. But one issue which I can safely address now relates to expert evidence at the CPO hearing. So Lord Briggs disagreed with us and disagreed with the Court of Appeal that the questioning and cross-examination of the experts had gone too far. And he held that that questioning had been appropriate in our case. However, he indicated that such an approach would be a rare occurrence and would be exceptional. So who decides? Well, of course, the tribunal can indicate that it would like to question the experts. But what approach should respondents take? And I note in this regard that Lord Briggs says that, in his view at least, the questioning and cross-examination of the experts in our case achieved a considerable improvement in the evidence. So in fact, the process operated in our favour, in his view at least. So that, of course, is another issue which will require careful consideration. The sixth point, carriage dispute. Since I'm instructed by Phil Evans, as Rachel noted at the outset, in the impending carriage dispute, I'm a little limited in what I can say in this regard. But plainly, where there are two or more overlapping applications, the CAT needs to resolve which, if either, goes forward. That decision is referred to in Canada as a carriage dispute, and that's the terminology which has come to be applied here. In Canada, it is determined at an very early preliminary stage as one of the first issues before the certification hearing. And we had a hearing in FX before the tribunal this time last year, in which we all argued that the same approach should be taken in this jurisdiction. And the tribunal disagreed and held that in FX at least, carriage should be determined at the same time as certification. The nature of the test to be applied in a carriage dispute remains at large. And of course, one question is, what impact, if any, will Merricks have, does the judgment in Merricks have on that right test, on the right test for carriage dispute? And my seventh and final point, what of the impact outside the CAT regime? So as Rachel noted in her introductory comments, I'm instructed by Richard Lloyd in his representative action under CPR 19.6 against Google. As many of you will know, we won in the Court of Appeal in respect of issues which are broadly equivalent to certification. And Google's appeal is due to be heard in April, in a couple of months. So in a sense, it's natural to conduct something of a compare and contrast between these two different regimes. One difference, which is stark, is the test for commonality. So in the CAT regime, the test is that the issues are the same, similar or related. Whereas in the 19.6 regime, the class members must all have the same interest in the claim, and that's a materially narrower test. In contrast, one similarity between the two regimes is the policy objective, namely providing a viable route to the court. And one sees in the judgment of the Court of Appeal in Lloyd and Google a clear recognition that if that representative action does not proceed, there will be no other remedy, since individual claims are simply not realistic. That has obvious resonance with Lord Briggs's judgment, which summarises the CAT regime as serving the statutory purpose of providing effective access to justice for claimants, for whom the pursuit of individual claims would be impracticable or disproportionate. So inasmuch as there is read across between those two regimes, and subject to what happens in Lloyd and Google in a couple of months, by way of general concluding remark, I would say there is an observable general opening up by means of collective redress in our courts and tribunals. And perhaps the bringing of more such claims is the most obvious consequence, I would think, of the Supreme Court's judgment in Merrick's. And on that observation, I would very gladly cede the ground to Rachel, who is, of course, the true expert in all matters of collective actions. Rachel, over to you.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much, Victoria and Christopher, on these fascinating presentations. At this stage, I've just been asked to give a five-minute presentation on a few wider issues on the law reform and academic aspects of the issues arising from Merrick's and MasterCard. So 5 points in 5 minutes. First of all, as Victoria has just said, it's remarkable, actually, to me, how supportive both the majority and the minority were in Merrick's and MasterCard about the concept of class actions and the concept of opt-out class actions. And then some very significant points made in both of those judgments about the access to justice that they render. So, not to try to bang the drum too much again, but, you know, it bears reminding. We are 25 years on since Lord Wolfe recommended in 1996 in his Access to Justice report that there be an opt-out class action introduced to the law of England and Wales. 25 years. And it is almost 15 years since the Civil Justice Council recommended a generic opt-out class action with respect to that something that could cope with any cause of action. Both of these models were predicated on the basis that it would be the court's decision whether it was opt-in or opt-out, but they both would have facilitated in their recommendation opt-out class action. And now we're still waiting, of course, but it bears, you know, it bears reminding that the common law world is moving on. New Zealand is currently consulting on opt-out class action reform due to close next month. The Western Australian Law Reform Commission recently looked at it. There have been three state regimes introduced in Australia since 2011. I mean, the world is moving on. And I think the supportive comments about the concept made in the Supreme Court do really bear noting. The second point is, of course, the government decided in this jurisdiction way back in 2009 that we would pursue a sectoral reform agenda. Now, as I mentioned previously, in 2008, the Civil Justice Council thought that generic opt-out reform would be the way to go, but the government did not agree with that recommendation and recommended sectoral only. And that's why we are here today with respect to a sectoral regime in competition law. Now, I don't know that I can say very much in favour of a sectoral reform, never have agreed with that, but there is one advantage, and I think that has been very clear in this litigation that we're discussing today, Merrick's and MasterCard. And that is that there, competition law class actions do involve unique legal, evidential, and economic issues. And inevitably, aggregation of damages, the distribution of damages, and the type of evidence which is required to substantiate an application at certification stage come to the very fore in competition law class actions. Now, the jurisprudence which Victoria mentioned, particularly process and the decision of the Supreme Court and the passage of Justice Rothstein, which is likely to be oft quoted before the CAT for many years to come. It's worth noting that Supreme Court decision was handed down in 2013. That's almost two decades after the British Columbia regime came into being. So in a generic regime, there's a lot of diffuse legal issues that need to be discussed and need to be resolved judicially, whereas in a competition law class action regime, there are some issues which come to the fore very quickly, and the evidential threshold that is required to be met at certification was indeed at issue in Merrick's and has been resolved at the Supreme Court level. So one advantage of a sectoral regime, I can't give it more than that. I think we need generic reform. As Lord Wolfe recommended a quarter of a century ago. The third point is that there's nothing to say that a generic class action regime would need to be worded in the same way that the current regime is. There will inevitably be lessons learned, tweaks made, but that's only natural in the evolution of drafting, I think. And one of these points that perhaps bears noting is the preliminary merits criterion. I think it's interesting to go back to the 2013 report of the government when it was giving its response to the BIS's departmental consultation proposal to introduce a competition law class action. And in that response, the government said, and I quote, "The government strongly agrees with the great majority of respondents that a certification regime is an important safeguard. The government has therefore decided that there should be a strong process of judicial certification, including a preliminary merits test." Now, as the Supreme Court decision, both majority and minority show, and as Victoria has already mentioned as one of her points, the threshold that will be required to be met will be a strikeout or summary judgment application threshold. It does not appear that that's going to be any higher than that, at least in relation to preliminary merits. But there is, of course, a wide variety of preliminary merits criteria that can be implemented. And one of the others, which was implemented in our regime, is the cost-benefit analysis in Rule 79.2b. Now, that has never required a lot of discussion before the CAT to this point. But no doubt, in judgments to come, there will be judicial interpretation so as to put wording onto those statutory bones, if you like. But it's fascinating to see how legislation is interpreted once it is enacted. And I think this particular point is one that is of great interest. And it is always controversial. With respect to the Ontario Law Reform Commission, they vehemently disagreed with what the Ontario legislature ended up enacting, which was no preliminary merits at all other than a cause of action on the face of the pleadings. It's always an issue which entices discussion at a law reform level. The fourth point is the point about statutory interpretation. I think that this decision all the way from the CAT to the Supreme Court shows how very learned and experienced judges can look at particular words or phrases and interpret them quite differently. And that's occurred throughout this litigation. But there were three instances, indeed, between the majority and the minority in Merricks and MasterCard. One was the interpretation of the word suitability. As Victoria has mentioned, it was considered to be a comparative analysis, according to Lord Briggs, whereas it's abstract in the views of others. Secondly, in relation to the strength of the claims phrase, it's considered with respect to the minority's view that is something that would be restricted to the Rule 79.3, and the majority thought differently. So in that respect, the interpretation of that phrase is just, what does it inform elsewhere in the legislative regime? Something which is really, really quite significant and upon which reasonable judicial opinion can differ. So I think that the statutory interpretation points that arise in this judgment are only reflective of the sorts of lessons and going forward when it comes to drafting any further regimes, that these lessons will be incredibly important for drafters as we go forward. And lastly, the significance of the common issue. Now, if common issues arise, as we know, twice in a class action regime, one is that there has to be at least one, and clearly there is two significant common issues in Merricks and MasterCard already, the merchant parcel issue and the overcharge issue. But it arises again, the common issue, under the suitability requirements and the eligibility criterion, as it's described. And so it comes back into play under Rule 79.2a. In that regard, I thought there was a very significant passage in Lord Briggs's judgment, because the UK legislature, no doubt deliberately, remained silent as to how significant the common issues have to be. Now, obviously, they're very significant in the Merricks and MasterCard litigation. That's not an issue. But moving forward to other cases, how significant do the common issues have to be? And Lord Briggs mentioned in paragraph 62 that he thought a potential plus factor in the balance of the suitability analysis is where a common issue, where all the big issues in a particular dispute are common issues. Now, that phraseology in paragraph 62 is really quite significant, because This issue has again troubled law commissions and judges around the common law world. How significant do the common issues have to be? And there have been a number of interpretations. Of course, the BC and US legislative regime require predominance. In relation to the Australian regime, the legislature put in that it has to be a substantial common issue of law or fact. Now, in the UK, of course, it's silent on this, and so this will require judicial interpretation, and Lord Briggs has already given a lead or a steer in that regard. But again, you know, it's a drafting issue, it's an interpretive issue, and it's one that no doubt, again, as I say, lessons will always be learnt in the evolution of class actions, drafting and interpretation. And so this, you know, looking at the bigger picture, this the litigation throughout, from the Katz and earlier judgments to the Supreme Court judgments, they have a fertile amount of thinking and learning as to how to appropriately draft such regimes. So they're my 5 points. I hope that was 5 minutes. And so at this stage, I can open up to the floor for any questions that audience members may have to any of our panelists. Do we have any questions at all that anybody would like to ask? Any questions at all? Perhaps I could just mention, ask one question of Christopher, because I was fascinated by your last slide, Christopher, where you mentioned that there were various other cases sitting behind the lead cases. And I just wondered how you think the CAT might manage those cases, given the number of them and the likely overlap of issues among those cases. Have you any thoughts about that going forward?
Thanks. So as Rachel's said, there are, and I think probably everyone attending this webinar will know that the lead cases are not the only retailer cases. Huge numbers of other retailers have jumped on the interchange bandwagon, having perhaps seen how the Court of Appeal judgment came out. and of course, a number of cases had been commenced even before that. And all of them were either expressly or effectively stayed pending the outcome of the appeals. So there is this question about how they should move forward. It's fair to say that they aren't all identical to the lead cases. So to take one example, the case I've referred to on my final slide, the June case, which is actually a large grouping of retailers represented by the same solicitors and counsel team. The pleading in that case, or in those cases, they've got one against MasterCard and one against Visa, I think, make allegations not only of breach of Article 101, but also Article 102. So just to take an example, just by way of example, not all cases are the same. And likewise, there are one or two cases out there which look a bit more like Victoria's Merrick's case. They are expressed as follow-on cases seeking to rely on the Commission's EEA myth case, and saying that as a result of the EEA myth infringement found by the Commission, definitively found, the domestic myth was inflated. So it's not to say that all of the cases are identical, but undoubtedly a lot of the cases will raise the same core issue as to whether the myth of one or both schemes infringes Article 101. And in particular, the question of exemption, because although the schemes, or at least MasterCard, I've got to be very careful, MasterCard has been found definitively not to have proved exemption in our case, that doesn't stop MasterCard having a go in another case. It's always open to them, to at least in principle, to come forward with better evidence and show that actually the myths in question are exempt, or myths at some level, some positive level, would be exempt. And because if a myth at half the level that was in fact set is would have been exempt and would have been set, then that's the starting point for the damages assessment. So that's all a very long way of getting to your question, Rachel. The tribunal, I don't know is the short answer, but I imagine the tribunal, one of the things they'll be wondering is whether they can group together a number of these cases to be resolved together, because the last thing the tribunal wants to do is to have a number of separate trials on the question, particularly on the question of exemption. It's almost inevitable that the quantum issue will have to be resolved on a case-by-case basis, a bit like is happening in the trucks litigation, because they do raise claimant-specific issues, obviously, pass on. But the exemption issue, it seems to me, is ripe for being dealt with together, at least insofar as the claims overlap temporally. Because, of course, some of the claims, if a claim has been brought 5 years after another claim, then actually there's going to be very little temporal overlap, and the arguments on exemption may differ from one period to another.
Thank you, Christopher. Thank you. We have a couple of questions that have come in from audience members, so may I just put these to you both. Fergus Randolph of Queen's Counsel asks the question that, given the importance of statutory interpretation, which has become so evident in the Merricks and MasterCard decision in particular, does the panel think that Pepper and Hart material will be used more in future cases? Would either of you like to comment on that?
Well, I think it's certainly the case that the conventional background materials to which one can have reference when construing a statute have come to the fore in these cases. And we had the various white papers and even, I think, the CJC report to which you referred, Rach. I'm not sure we went quite back to Lord Wolfe, but we did have a lot of that background matrix material in. And I totally agree, Fergus, that I think, given the importance of statutory interpretation, that sort of approach will continue. I'm not sure whether pure Pepper and Hart would be nuanced as a consequence, but I totally agree that all eyes need to be on what Parliament intended when it introduced the scheme. Absolutely.
And indeed, Victoria, you also mentioned about the usefulness of Canadian jurisprudence. We're all going to have to get on top, learn the Canadian law awfully quickly. But of course, there are key differences in the legislative wording, isn't there, between our regime and Ontario's, British Columbia's, which themselves are not identical. So these key differences in wording will become incredibly important as we go forward, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a really interesting article with which you'll be familiar, I'm sure, that was written by Lord Reed about that, how one conducts this kind of comparative analysis and the risk that we do it badly, actually, that we're ill-informed and that we don't take all the necessary steps which we should take. And if we're just saying, oh, look, here's something that's inspirational, but it's not actually a direct comparison, that's fine and one can do it in a slightly ignorant way. But if one is really trying to say this regime and our regime are the same, then you need to know an awful lot about it. Frankly, you should probably be Canadian law qualified, shouldn't you, really, to make that sort of submission. But I agree, we'll be looking there a lot more.
Christopher, this may be one for you, one from Mr. Burrows. Is there a tension between the upstream pass-on principle, that is, damages reduced for cost reductions achieved from suppliers, and the broader common law principle that claimants should, where reasonable, mitigate their loss, and failure to do so could reduce loss?
I'm not sure there's a tension. Maybe Victoria's smiling as if she's perhaps got some thoughts on this. What I would say,
I think it feels like we're in a supervision, doesn't it, at this point?
It does, yeah. Oh gosh. what I would say about this cost negotiations point, perhaps just taking it back to where it all came from. The tribunal dedicated quite a bit of its judgment to the issue of pass on and explained that there are four different ways in which a business could react to the imposition of a cost. And those four ways were basically do nothing, just sort of take the hit, seek to reduce discretionary expenditure on things like advertising and marketing, assuming it wants to otherwise keep its overall costs at the same level. The third is to go to its suppliers and say, look, we now want to drive a harder bargain with you. And the fourth is increasing its own prices, so the classic pass-on. The Court of Appeal said that fourth, the Court of Appeal's judgment concentrated on that fourth type of reaction, said that is pass-on as the law understands it. If I recall correctly, MasterCard didn't raise in its appeal that the cost reductions point was also a form of legally relevant passing on. But nonetheless, the Supreme Court judgment has told us, Supreme Court has told us that it is. There's going to be an issue, I think, in some, if not all, cases, as to whether any cost reductions were caused by the overcharge. Because in a business which is as sophisticated as Sainsbury's, you'd really be expecting, and I think perhaps the evidence in the Sainsbury's MasterCard case was to the effect that a business like Sainsbury's will inevitably drive the hardest bargain it can with its various suppliers. And so if in any event bargaining took place with suppliers to improve terms, it may be rather difficult to show that that was the consequence of the overcharge, because it would have been, it's something that Sainsbury's would look to do in any event. It wasn't caused by the overcharge. So I guess I have some doubts as to whether that's going to be a big issue in practice. It may be, but I just put that out there. But I'm not sure. I'm not sure that there is the sort of tension that that Ewan's getting at. But perhaps I've misunderstood the question. I don't know, Victoria. Thank you,
Christopher. Yes, final minute, Victoria. Any further comment about that question?
It's not something which I thought about a lot, but I do think it would be a bit strange, wouldn't it, if one could rely on the common law obligation to mitigate, to say, well, look, even though you didn't, in fact, pass on in those senses, you know, negotiating a harder bargain, you should have done so. And so we're going to deduct the amount you should have extracted from your suppliers from your entitlement to damages. I mean, that would seem extraordinary to me, but as I say, I haven't thought about it in any great detail.
Nevertheless, both very helpful responses. Thank you. We have no further questions in the Q&A, nothing in the chat. So, and we are right on time. So I think at that point, it behoves me to conclude the seminar. Nicholas, would you like to say any concluding points before we...
Thank you. Rachel and Victoria and Kit again for making time for us this lunchtime. It's been very informative, very much appreciated, and I hope that we can't do a round of applause on the webinar. At least I'm not going to do it on my own, but I'm sure that everybody is very appreciative and will show that appreciation in their feedback forms, which they will all fill out dutifully.